The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. You can get to the live video stream of this program at trumpetdaily.com and also at the Rumble channel, rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. No cold open for today's show. That's because we've got a special show lined up for today and one that I think you'll enjoy very, very much. Even if you happen to see the ceremony that we had a week and a half ago for the Tell Dan Steely, you'll still like today's presentation. It kind of condenses all of the guest speakers, even some of the music that we had for that ceremony. So I think the ceremony itself went for about an hour and a half. And so what we have today, we've squeezed into the 55-minute block. And of course, to learn more about the exhibit, just go to armstronginstitute.org and you can learn about the House of David inscription that we just found a home for in Armstrong Auditorium a couple weeks ago. So with that, we will carry on with the ceremony from September 22nd.
Our eyes are ever eastward through. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Shalom Eretov to our wonderful friends in Israel. Today's a difficult day, but an important day in Israel. The war effort in the north has progressed. Our hearts and prayers are with all of our friends in Israel. We're grateful you could join us for this most exciting and historic event. We are here today to celebrate the arrival in America of what we would consider one of humanity's most important artifacts, the Tel Dan Stele, or the House of David inscription. This priceless piece of ancient history has been to America only once, in 2014, when it was briefly exhibited at the prestigious Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. So Armstrong Auditorium and the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology is honored and enormously grateful to display this item and to share it with the people of Oklahoma and beyond. King David is one of the most famous figures in world history and an iconic personality in the canon of Western civilization. Even today, 3,000 years later, David remains a household name. If the West created a Mount Rushmore of its greatest, most important figures, one could make a strong case that King David should be on there, perhaps beside Shakespeare and Churchill. David was the world's first Renaissance man. He was a warrior and king, a poet and musician, a shepherd and farmer, a husband and father. He was the patriarch of an enduring royal dynasty of kings, one that echoes even into modern times. The Bible tells us that David was unique and exceptional, a man after God's own heart. Yet David's life also epitomizes the human condition, one so familiar to us all. He was conflicted, flawed, incomplete. David's life and legacy has been an inspiration for thousands of years in Western art and culture, be it Michelangelo's famous sculpture, Caravaggio's masterful David and Goliath, or in the countless literary references of supreme authors like Shakespeare, Milton, and Dickens. In religion, David is central to Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. The name David is mentioned more than 1,000 times in the Bible. To Christians, he is perhaps the greatest biblical figure after Jesus Christ. And we know that Jesus himself was a descendant of King David. To our Jewish brothers, King David's legacy is deeply woven into the religious, cultural, and historical fabric of Judaism and Israel's identity. King David, even today, is an epic figure. But was he real? There was a time when this question was widely debated. Many scholars were convinced that David was a work of fiction and that the Hebrew Bible was useless as a historical source. In 1992, one popular scientist summarized the view of many scholars and Bible skeptics when he published a book in which he wrote, "Whoever is living in the Palestinian highlands around 1000 BCE, that's the time of David and Solomon, they do not think, look, or act like the people the biblical writers have put there. They are literary creations." Unfortunately for him, this scorching denunciation of David and the Bible was poorly timed. This is because 6 months after his book was published, the House of David inscription was found. The discovery of the Tel Dan Stele was an earthquake in the world of biblical archaeology and Bible scholarship. The conversation about Israel's greatest king suddenly and dramatically changed. Scholars could no longer claim King David or the Kingdom of Israel or the House of David was a work of fiction, a literary creation. From now on, the conversation and debate would revolve around the nature, that's the size, the power and influence, the regional importance of Israel under King David and his descendants. Was the kingdom David and Solomon established truly as illustrious and monumental as the Bible describes? This question is at the center of the Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered exhibit. And the House of David inscription is the key, archaeologically, that unlocks the answer. This is why it is so important, and this is why it completes our Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered exhibit. Before I introduce the next two speakers, we would like to just extend our heartfelt gratitude to some friends and organizations in Israel without whom this moment would not be possible. First, we're grateful to the State of Israel and to the wonderful people of Israel. We understand that this is your most important archaeological find, that it's the only object inscribed with the name of your greatest king, and that it powerfully attests to your 3,000-year connection to Jerusalem and to Judea and Samaria. And we will, I promise, guard it with our lives.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone, and as we heard earlier, a special welcome to all of our friends in Israel who are watching online. My father was hoping to address everyone today, but yesterday he wasn't feeling so well, so he too is at home watching online. At an event celebrating King David, I can't help but to think about the late Dr. Eilat Mazar and even her grandfather. I forget what year it was when he died, back in the 80s, I believe. Professor Benjamin Mazar and all of the important archaeology that the Mazar family has done revolving around the First Temple period and especially King David. As I think back on our working relationship with Dr. Mazar, Eilat Mazar, David really was the connecting point. We read a story about King David's palace. That was back in 2006, and it got our attention. My colleague and I flew to Israel. We met Dr. Mazar before the second excavation she was to have at the City of David. And that began a 20-year relationship, almost anyway, 18, I guess, to be precise. And we were at City of David for some of those years. We were at the Ophel, just north of the City of David. And as we started to study more about Dr. Mazar's work, so much of it did revolve around King David. She had this unforgettable headline back in 1997, where she, looking into the Bible, knew in her mind where King David's palace would have been situated. And so she had a beautiful picture with her article of the City of David, and then this bright red arrow that said, "It's right there. That's where King David's palace is." And she wasn't able to start digging there for another 8 years, I think it was, because she didn't have the funding. So she was very passionate. She used the Bible as her guide. And once she started digging, she found all kinds of things regarding the First Temple period and David in particular. If she were still with us today, she would be very, very proud right now. She was not one to travel outside of Israel. She loved Israel. But I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that if she was still with us, she would have made the trip to Oklahoma, finally. We would have twisted her arm, something fierce. As I say, we first began our work in Jerusalem in 2006, helping at the City of David. Since then, we've worked alongside Eilat and her team on many, many digs over the years, including her final dig in 2018 on the Ophel. And our archaeology work on the Ophel continues. Just today, in fact, we completed the final day of excavation on the latest stage of the Ophel excavation alongside Professor Liebner of Hebrew University. And over the years, we've been privileged to have participated in the discovery of some really astonishing finds, the large stone structure that is King David's palace, the monumental walls of King Solomon's Jerusalem, the Hezekiah Bulla, the Isaiah Bulla. We've had those on display in past exhibits, the Bulla of the two Judean princes, mentioned in Jeremiah 36. We've excavated the wall of Nehemiah, and of course, we also have participated in the one that turned up the 70 AD destruction coins and that golden menorah. We've featured all of that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and our Trumpet magazine. And here we are today, exhibiting the greatest artifact in the world related to King David. It really is hard to believe. I visited the Tel Dan site. It's about 100 miles north of Jerusalem. We saw it back in 2011. That's where they discovered the stele. And of course, it's been on display at the Israel Museum. It's only been outside of the country of Israel once, as Brad McDonald was mentioning. But it really and truly is hard to believe that it's here in Oklahoma, of all places. Everyone that's familiar with archaeological excavations and artifacts they keep saying, how in the world did you get that to Oklahoma? So it's here, and as Mr. McDonald said, it really does complete our exhibit out in the lobby. I knew, as I say, Dr. Mazar very well. We spent many hours talking and writing emails, sharing theories, and as I say, so much of it did revolve around the Davidic dynasty. One of Dr. Mazar's most famous phrases was, let the stones speak. I heard her say this dozens of times. I think it appears in most articles about her work. As she said, that's basically the gist of that red arrow in 1997. Hey, let's put the theory to the test and start digging. And we'll let the stones speak and test my theory and see if it's right. And she was right. We love that phrase. In fact, we have used that phrase. That's what we titled our magazine on archaeology, Let the Stones Speak. It's also the name of our podcast. And so here we are with perhaps the most important stone in the world regarding, you know, the message that it has, the house of David. King David was real. The kingdom of Israel was real. The dynasty of David was real. And what does all of this mean? It means that the biblical text is real and authentic. We can trust the Bible as a historical source, among other things. As I say, Dr. Mazar used it to guide her in her work. And she was not a religious woman in so many ways. This is from a 2002 book called The Bible Unearthed. It's by Israel Finkelstein and Neil Silberman. And I think both of them would be considered somewhat skeptical of some of the biblical record. But regarding the Tell Dan Steely, they said, this is dramatic evidence of the fame of the Davidic dynasty less than 100 years after the reign of David's son, Solomon. The fact that Judah, or perhaps its capital, Jerusalem, is referred to with only a mention of its ruling house is clear evidence that the reputation of David was not a literary invention of a much later period. They write, the house of David was known throughout the region. This clearly validates the biblical description of a figure named David becoming the founder of the dynasty of Judahite kings in Jerusalem. We're grateful for the House of David inscription, as it really does complete our exhibit, an exhibit which reveals a story and history that has never been more important. As we gather here today, the state of Israel is engaged in war with terrorists in Gaza, now Lebanon, who want nothing less than to vanquish the Jewish state and the Jewish people. Tragically, these evil forces receive sympathy and support from too many people in the West. Many today fail to understand Israel's history, its connection to Jerusalem and the Holy Land, and its central role in Western civilization. This is why this exhibit and the House of David inscription is so crucial and so timely. Never has it been more important that we understand Israel's history, its deep connection to Jerusalem, to Judea, Samaria, to King David, and the House of David. When you understand and appreciate this history, you understand why Israel must fight to defend itself, and not just itself, also the Bible and even Western civilization. Dr. Mazar understood this well. She said, if you don't understand our history, you won't be willing and prepared to defend the nation, our people, and culture. This history unites our people. The Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology is proud to exhibit the beautiful history of the Jewish people and the State of Israel. The House of David inscription will help us do this more effectively. We look forward to many future projects in Jerusalem and Israel, and will remain fervent in our support and love for Israel and her brave people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted and honored to be back. I was here just a few months ago, my first visit, and I didn't expect to be back so soon. In fact, I was just gearing up for my promotional tour on the new film. Earlier today, I was on the Trumpet Daily podcast. I was thinking, I'm on the Trumpet Daily podcast, and what am I doing? But I'm trumpeting Trump. Pretty interesting. I feel utterly unqualified to be giving this keynote address. My own work on Israeli archaeology is woefully incomplete, to put it mildly. And I want to approach this marvelous artifact, this marvelous stela, from a somewhat different angle or point of view. To me, you have in front of us here in Oklahoma, and that itself is something of a miracle. Debbie and I just watched the movie Twisters. And first of all, it's obviously an attack on the state of Oklahoma. Because it appears that nothing happens here except twisters, one after the other. In fact, as I was walking up here, I couldn't resist the image of the Tell Dan Stela being sucked up in a twister. And I thought, you better make sure this stone is like bolted down. That would not be, that you'd have a lot of explaining to do to the Israeli Antiquities Authority. Let the stone speak, but what is this particular stone saying? What is the message of the stone? Well, to me, to put it in almost crude terms, it is kind of God's Leroy was here. I think you know what I mean. When you go visit a place, you have people go, Debbie was here. You just kind of scrawl that out there, hoping that maybe someday someone will see it. The figure of David has been considered over many centuries, even by skeptics, a kind of marvelous literary creation, an incredible dramatic story, the ultimate story of the underdog, that's David against Goliath. And then the astounding story of David and Bathsheba, which I think establishes David not just as an adulterer, but a horrific criminal who sends a man, an innocent man, to his death for no other reason other than the fact that he has designs on the man's wife. How can a figure so dubious, so suspect, be one of the great heroes of the Bible and one of the great heroes of Western civilization? It's important to note here that we're not talking merely about the history of ancient Israel or even Israel generally. We're talking about our history. Why? Because when the American founders crossed the pond, when they came here to America, and when their forefathers did, they brought with them Athens, and they brought with them Jerusalem. They brought with them the legacy of David. They brought with them the teachings of the Bible. And in the story of David, you have this climactic scene where the prophet Nathan approaches the king on his throne and tells him a story about a rich man who had many lambs and was planning a great banquet. But instead of using one of his lambs or several of his lambs, he goes to the poor man and takes his lamb. And the Bible tells us that David's anger burned. And David basically says, this man deserves to be severely punished, if not killed. And then the prophet Nathan points to David and goes, you are that man. And I think that the remarkable thing about this is, and this explains David in a nutshell, as they say, David's reaction. The normal reaction would be, execute that man. Get him out of here. But for David, that's not his reaction. David's reaction is, I have sinned before God. And so it is the repentance of David, the humility of David, that in a sense is morally etched on the Western soul through the centuries. And yet, it appeared until relatively recently that David was, in fact, a kind of story. These people can't be real. Was Job real? Was there really a place where a guy named Job lived? Could these figures in the Hebrew scriptures from Isaiah to Jeremiah, could they be real? And even if they were real, how would we know? They're lost in the mist of time. What possible record could be left that would attest to the actuality, which is to say the historicity of these figures? They seem to be lost in time. And in a sense, you may say that the entire system of beliefs of the West, the idea of Jerusalem, which of course is an idea that is embraced not just by the Jews, but also by Christianity, Jerusalem appears to be entirely in the province of faith or revelation, while Athens appears to be squarely in the province of reason. And that's kind of the way most people have understood it. Athens reflects the critical mind. It's the place of Socrates. It is the place of the birthplace of philosophy. That's where we use our brains. Jerusalem is essentially the antithesis of that. Jerusalem is God says so. Jerusalem is take it on faith. Jerusalem is faith is somehow better than reason. And this has created, in some sense, the bifurcation of the Western mind. Much of the attack on Jerusalem today comes in the name of Athens. You could almost say that the Enlightenment, in a nutshell, is mobilizing the spirit of Athens against the spirit of Jerusalem. Reason reigns supreme. You can't believe the Bible. How can you trust all that stuff? It doesn't make any sense. And yet, it seems that in this secular age that we're living in, this age of skepticism, of disbelief, but not just disbelief, that would be one thing. It is also the age of the utter flouting and rejection of the moral code that comes out of Jerusalem. Look at the Old Testament, and it's, I'm sure if you lived in America 50 years ago, let's just say 1953, you walked around the country, you talked to people, and you said, do you agree that the Ten Commandments is a really good way to live? If everybody lived by the Ten Commandments, would America be a better society, yes or no? I think you'd find that 99% of Americans, whether Christian or Jewish or nothing at all, would go, yeah, sure, of course, obviously. And that's the point, is that while Western civilization was built, was incubated, was developed in a horizon in which the belief of God and the belief in an external moral code was obvious, we are living at a time when it is not only not obvious, but we are living in a time when there is a multidimensional attack on not just the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but also the moral code that was, in a sense, given by that God through Moses and in other forms, through the commandments. This is all under siege. And it's under siege from people who say things like, well, gee, I don't know, Dinesh, I mean, you got a sacred book. Everybody's got a sacred book. The Hindus have sacred books, the Bhagavad Gita. The ancient Greeks believed in all kinds of, well, we call it Greek mythology. Do you really believe there was a Mount Olympus? You really believe that that stuff was real? You really believe that there was an Achilles and there was the human beings interacted with the gods? That's made up stuff. So if you have a holy book and they have a holy book, how do you know your holy book is real? I think it is in this context that we should think about biblical archaeology. Biblical archaeology is almost as if God has decided in this most secular time in the world to start speaking back. And he's doing it through the stones. So the stones actually aren't speaking. Stones can't speak. God is speaking through the stones. And what God is saying, it seems, is that I'm going to take some of the most iconic moments in this astounding Hebrew scriptures, and I'm going to show you that they're real. Now, we already had other intimations, because the Bible makes astounding claims that on the face of it appear to be not only unverifiable, but somewhat ridiculous. Even David. There was a huge, a powerful dynasty in Israel that dominated the region. Wait, what? What about the Egyptians? What about the Babylonians? What about the Assyrians? What about the Hittites? I mean, we know that there were these massive, powerful empires. Are you telling me that little Israel sort of whipped them all and became the greatest of them all? What? Well, as it turns out, and as we learn now and only now, those dynasties had almost mysteriously subsided around the period of Solomon and Saul and David. And there was a period in which all those dynasties, oddly enough, different as they were, seemed to be kind of flat on their back. And you had a period of Israelite ascendancy. And then that period of ascendancy was over, and those dynasties experienced a revival. This is not a matter of faith. This is actually now a matter of fact. And the Bible tells us all these things from the first line of the Old Testament, as we say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means, and the further insinuation that God did this out of nothing. Now, right there, you have something that contradicts what the ancient Greeks believed. The ancient Greeks believed that out of nothing can only come nothing. And therefore, in ancient Greece, the belief was God has to be some sort of a divine craftsman who takes existing materials that must have been there forever and then carpenter style remakes them into the world that we have now. But the idea that you could make something out of nothing, well, that's crazy. And yet that is asserted as a fact in the Bible. And it's asserted by a group of Hebrew writers who have not conducted any experiments and not done even really any philosophical speculations, but essentially have said, God told me. God told me. And yet, if we fast forward to now, to the most recent discoveries of modern physics and cosmology, we learn, in fact, you learn in a physics classroom in any decent university in the first 3 weeks, that first there was nothing, and then there was a universe. That in fact the biblical account is supported by the latest knowledge of modern physics and cosmology. And then the Bible talks about this remarkable group of people, the Jews. And the Bible says categorically, well, first of all, it says categorically that these are the people of God. God chose them. Now, it's why God chose them, I think, is just as big a mystery in Israel as it is to us. Why them? The writer Hilaire Belloc many years ago composed a poem that went like this: how odd of God to choose the Jews. That's the poem. And it's not because of the supreme virtues of Abraham or the spotless moral life of David. It appears that God chose the Jews to represent something in the world. To represent, if you will, God's laws. God's preferred way of life for man. And very interestingly, the Bible says that this people, scattered, will return to their ancestral homeland. Now, you have to really just look at history to see what an implausible prophecy that is. Prophecies, by the way, are valid in direct proportion to their implausibility. What I mean by that is that if I say something, hey, I'm going to toss a coin, and guess what? It's going to come out heads. Well, yeah, that's interesting, but I got a 1 in 2 chance of that happening. If I say I'm going to spin a roulette wheel that has numbers 1 to 100 and you're going to get number 89, that's a somewhat more impressive prophecy because the chances of that happening are pretty low. When you consider the Jews dispersed since around 70 AD, scattered to the far winds of the earth, the idea that they would not just come back and reunite, but reunite exactly in the place where they started? What's the chance of that? So this is a people that have very much in the spirit of biblical prophecy persisted. And perhaps the most astounding thing for me, Debbie and I visited Israel for the first time. My wife Debbie is here, by the way. Honey, you want to stand up and just be acknowledged? We must confess that we've been lots of places, but Israel had a very peculiar and dramatic impact on us for a number of reasons. I mean, part of it, I suppose, is that these are days when you travel, much of the world is beginning to look the same, right? I mean, you go these days to Oslo or Copenhagen. Well, I mean, you might as well be in Milwaukee. I mean, sure, you have some guys in suits riding a bicycle, or every third guy's named Sven. But aside from that, the stores, the ambiance is the same. Not in Israel. Right away, you know that you are in a modern society, but one that remains anchored in the old world. And the world of the Bible is visible in Israel now. I think the thing that struck us even more than that was that you have archaeologists in Israel, and we met some of them, who in the spirit of Dr. Eilat Mazar, they tell us, we approach archaeology with the Bible in the left hand and our tools in the right hand. So if we're looking, let's say, for Sodom and Gomorrah, we don't just go start digging. We read the Bible, and it gives you clues about what Abraham saw and where the mountain was and where the smoke came from. And we apply those clues and we go look there. And we see what we find. And I want to emphasize that this is not some kind of theological hocus pocus. This is actually very sound archaeology. In fact, it's a very sound way to go about finding things out in general. Let's say you were trying to figure out whether the Trojan War really happened. How would you do that? Let's say you're trying to find out not only whether it happened, but where it happened. Well, you'd obviously pick up Homer's Iliad in one hand and Homer's Odyssey in the other, and you'd look for clues. There are these two whirlpools, Scylla and Charybdis. Okay, well, let's go and look and see where that kind of current can be found, where ships can be lost if they go left or if they go right. In other words, you would use the text to make predictions, and then you would go search to see if those predictions prove to be corroborated. That's exactly what Dr. Mazar is doing. And again, that is not biblical speculation. That is, in fact, using an ancient text as a clue or marker to then go and look and dig for artifacts. And so this concept of biblical archaeology is very astounding and not something that we actually, certainly I didn't, know a lot about. I feel silly saying this because I spent several years around between 2008 and 12 debating a lot of the world's leading atheists on universities around America and sometimes abroad. People like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, the philosopher Daniel Dennett. And we would debate cosmology and physics and history. But somehow, of the field of biblical archaeology, I knew nothing. Nothing. And yet, I think that is the field that is going to make the difference in the years ahead, because as people all over the world with a secular mindset are able either directly go see the Tel Dan Stela or through media. One of the things that I want to do, Debbie and I want to do, is make a film that encompasses these themes so people who don't see, people who aren't lucky enough to be here, who aren't lucky enough to go to Israel, can see for themselves the way in which God is speaking back through the stones. And I'll conclude by emphasizing that for me, this is a story that is not just about the past, and it's not even just about the present. It is about the deep linkage between the past and the present, the ancient past, and the present and the future. Why? Because if one looks around the world, it doesn't take a great deal of sort of strategic genius to recognize that the conflicts of 3,000 years ago are in only a slightly modified form back with us now. What? How can that even be possible? Well, here is Israel, circa 1000 BC, and it's surrounded by hostile enemies. And Israel is the Israelites are the people of God, and you have to say that the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Moabites and the Philistines, they're the enemies of God, at least in that context. And so there is a cosmic battle that is an actual battle, but it's a battle that reverberates with, you may say, cosmic significance, because it involves good and evil in the widest scale. And then we fast forward to now, and what do we see? The same people, the Israelites, the Jews, in the same place, surrounded by hostile enemies, enemies dedicated to wiping Israel off the map. And there's even a kind of peculiar particularity to this. Who are the Palestinians? Where do we get that name? Well, the name Palestinian is derived from the word Philistine. And just as the Philistines were an ancient enemy of Israel, in some way you could argue, I'm not saying in the identical form, because obviously we've had the intervention of Islam, the enemies of ancient Israel were, in some sense, you could say pagans, worshippers of idols. Now we have an enemy, radical Islam, that oddly enough is within the Abrahamite tradition. Radical Islam claims to be the final revelation of the God of Israel, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And we have a new conflict going on now. And all of this completes the Bible. In other words, the Bible remarkably combines a discussion from the very beginning. In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. You couldn't start before that. In fact, that's a passage that's long puzzled me. In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. Who's talking? It can't be God, because it doesn't say in the beginning, I made the heavens and the earth. Evidently, somebody else was there. But who? So, from the beginning, the Bible draws us in with mystery. And yet, as I said, you have the remote past connected to the biblical present, and then the role of the prophet, the Israelite prophets, is to make critiques of the present as a way of pointing to the future. And so there's a beautiful completeness to the Bible. And the only question we have is, will that completeness be somehow reflected in the actual history of the world as it plays out? Because the history of the world is still going on. We don't know the end. That's a story that hasn't ended. And by ended, I mean achieved its the completion of the story. But there are hints about it in the Hebrew scriptures. And so for me, all of this is a way of illuminating not just the ancient past. There was this great King David. He's a moral exemplar. We can learn a lot from him. But also, how does this cosmic drama play out in our own lives? And how does it play out in the actual history that is unfolding before our eyes? I want to commend and congratulate you for somehow, I mean, you Oklahomans are known for your shifty bargaining techniques. How you convinced the Israelis to part with this priceless artifact and bring it here. How you staged it so all the other bidders were out of the room, or actually their planes landed at the wrong airport. I don't know. But you did it. I commend you for doing it. This is the place to be. Debbie and I are delighted to be here. And thank you for having me be part of this marvelous exhibit and this wonderful exhibition. Thank you very much.